From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back in April of 2012, a 34-year-old homeless man born in Vietnam bought a knife at the Smith's Marketplace just off 4th South in Salt Lake City, went into the parking lot and attacked two white men. He almost killed both of them. The man's name was Kiet Tan Le. He said the attacks were in retribution for the Vietnam War. And while he was too young to have been directly involved in the war, his family's life had been defined by it. For the poet and writer Paisley Rekdal, this story became an obsession. Rekdal was most interested in what the man represented, as she saw it, the trauma of being a refugee and our continued fascination with the Vietnam War. Rekdal has written a book exploring her obsession. She's joining us today to talk about it. The book is called The Broken Country. Join us after the news.
Hello, podcast listener. This is Elaine Clark. I'm one of the producers for Radio West. You'll notice today's show's a little bit shorter than usual. It's because it's KUER's Fall Fun Drive, so you're missing out on several minutes of appeal to support the station, Radio West, and the podcast you're listening to. But you're savvy. You know how it works. KUER relies on your support to make this all possible. If you're already a sustainer, thank you. If not, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Just go to our website, radiowest.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The first chapter of Paisley Rekdal's book lays out the excruciating details of the crime. Early afternoon in late April, Kelton Barney is walking across the parking lot of the Smith's Marketplace on 5th East in Salt Lake City when he's violently stabbed 9 times. One cut went right through his left arm, almost bled to death. Another man, Tim DeJulis, stabbed in the head, suffered severe brain trauma, significant memory loss. They were attacked by a 34-year-old homeless drug addict named Kiet Tan Le, a man born in South Vietnam. It's a country that no longer exists. Le targeted white men. He told police a voice in his head insisted they were the ones to attack, that this was payback for what the U.S. had done to Vietnam during the war there. Le was one of the hundreds of thousands of refugees who came to the U.S. after the fall of Saigon. And when the writer Paisley Rekdal started paying attention to the story, all she knew about him was what she could see in his police record. Rekdal said Kiet Tan Le had lived most of his life in the Salt Lake Valley, disowned by family and largely forgotten by friends. Rekdal is an English professor at the University of Utah and a poet, the poet laureate for Utah, in fact. But her latest book is a departure. She's using the attack at the Smiths to examine the cultural and psychological effects of the trauma of war. Her book is called The Broken Country.
Well, I happened to be living in Hanoi, Vietnam at that time, right next to the Vietnam Military History Museum. And that's important to me because I was visiting this sculpture, this memorial sculpture, like every single day. It's actually the cover of the book. It's this pile of American and French planes shot down during the different wars. I was mesmerized by that memorial. And I happened to be on Facebook on an illegal VPN site like everyone is in Vietnam.
Right.
And I heard about this crime. I mean, the crime is that a young Vietnamese, youngish Vietnamese-American man named Kiet Tan Le, who's homeless and had problems with mental health problems and also drug and alcohol addiction, went into Smith's, purchased a knife, went out into the parking lot and started randomly stabbing specifically white men while yelling things that suggested this was in retribution for the Vietnam War, a war that he himself could not have personally experienced because he was born 3 years after, you know, April 1975. But he certainly experienced it in other ways with his family and as a refugee. So I heard about this. And the reason it went on Facebook was actually I teach at the University of Utah. And one of the students that in our program in the English department, Kelton Barney, had been stabbed. And so people were quite horrified. And I thought, this is just an insane crime. And I forgot about it. And I'd been thinking and thinking about that memorial sculpture in the war. And when I came back to Salt Lake, I thought, well, what took place? You know, how did it end? And the trial was still going. And then I started doing research.
What did you think you wanted to do with that story? And what made you think you wanted to write a book about it? And did you ever think, as a poet, that you wanted to write poetry about it?
No, I never ever thought I wanted to write poetry about it. When you write in different genres, you have an almost instinctual sense about what can work in a genre.
Yeah.
And what can work in poetry is a series of questions. And if there's anything poetic about this book, it's that in some ways it raises questions and it mulls through questions. But there are some places I get to that I just can't find answers to. But I knew from the beginning that I wanted to write some sort of piece of nonfiction. I didn't want to write a book. In fact, I was terrified of writing this. This is not the kind of work I normally do. I don't work as a journalist. I haven't done a lot of oral history work. I don't do cultural studies. And this is a book that basically required me to do all of these things, along with some philosophy, along with some history. So when I started working on it, I thought, maybe I can just do an essay. But it got bigger and bigger, and the questions got larger and larger about transgenerational trauma and what that means.
Yeah.
And by the time I was deep into it, I was actually having mild panic attacks thinking, oh, this is a book. Yeah. Which just was not a book.
How much of this was personal?
Not as... in some ways, more than I expected. In some ways, not where I expected.
Now, let's explain why I asked that question. You're biracial.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea is kind of a theme that does come up in the book.
Yeah.
So that's why I ask how much of this is related to the way you've been thinking about your own racial identity, I guess.
You know, what's fascinating about the biracial identity that I possess versus the biracial identity that Ketan Lee might have been playing with himself. I don't think he was actually biracial, but there was
rumors.
But
he said he was, right?
Or potentially, there's a rumor that he said he was.
Said, yes.
And but I think that if he did have a sort of disturbed appropriation of the Vietnam War, it's a perfect kind of metaphor to use, being biracial, because in some respects he was certainly bi-national, and
yeah.
He certainly had a transnational kind of identity, and he couldn't resolve that in some primary, you know, very deep ways, it seemed. At least I speculate on that.
Yeah.
But it's very different than the biracial identity that I possess. I mean, I'm half Chinese and half Norwegian. I am the descendant of immigrants on both sides of my family. But immigrants are different than refugees. We come with much more community support. We have more resources. We choose where we live. Refugees don't have any of these things, by and large. And Southeast Asian refugees, while I was familiar being biracial with some of the issues that assimilation and racism can present, I mean, it's a very different kind of experience than somebody who comes to the country with very little language, very little knowledge of what the country is about, potentially, and somebody who is not, like me, going to be able to pass as white, potentially, to certain kinds of audiences, and yet might have a disturbed fantasy of wanting to do that and what that means. So that there's a certain form of what I call and talk about as racial melancholy,
yeah,
that might infect this story that I would be familiar with, but it gave me enough of a sense of what was at stake, but also a sense of distance that I knew there was more that I didn't know.
So there's the story that you tell when you were in Vietnam. You were in Saigon, and you had gotten lost. And it was nighttime, and you were trying to figure your way back. And there was this man who comes behind you, stands next to you. I found this to be a really powerful story. Would you talk a little bit about this? And I may have you read this section if you would.
Do you want me to read it first?
Yeah, well, set it up for us and then
okay.
Read it. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm in Saigon and basically lost, as you say. And there are very few Amerasians left in Vietnam. But I seem to have run into, thank you, one of them. Anyway, so I should say one thing. There is a kind of look that biracial people give each other when you recognize each other.
Really?
It's just this moment. You're like, oh, I see you. And then
right.
you move on.
Yeah.
And that's what this was. So this is the section. I'm reminded of a late night I spent lost and alone in Saigon. I had just left a crowded restaurant and got turned around on my way back to the hotel. On a street corner filled with shops selling plastic flowers, I stopped to dig out the dog-eared map I'd gotten from a friend. As I squinted at the paper, I felt someone emerge from the shadowy doorway behind me. I looked up and saw a man, older than me perhaps, with long and rough-looking hair. He was alone, I noticed, and he held the thin, torn flaps of his shirt collar closed with one hand. He did not speak to me. He simply stood beside me in the dark, like me, perhaps, waiting for a break to open in the traffic. I went back to my map but could feel him look at me, suddenly, hard in the face. I raised my head and saw his round, double-lidded eyes, the high cheekbones, his skin darkened by years of living in the sun. His nose and mouth looked just like mine. He stared at my face, then looked down at my jacket, my clean jeans. Something in the two of us shifted, recognized each other. He took a step back from me. Then a rift in the traffic opened, and I crossed. You know, I'm the product of historical luck in so many ways. And what was funny to me about living in Hanoi and Vietnam is that, you know, I don't always think about being biracial, but there are moments that it erupts, and I am reminded very much about what it means to be biracial. And it sounds absurd to go to a place that has been so marked by a war with our country and sort of think that I wouldn't have a political meaning there. And my age puts me at exactly the age that they would imagine a returning Amerasian to coming, you know, come back on their shores. And when I lived in Hanoi, I was really surprised by how much attention I drew. Lots of people would come up to me all the time and, you know, sort of say, are you Vietnamese? Are you Asian peoples? And they were really excited in ways that I was frankly surprised by, because I had heard, like many, many listeners probably would hear, that the Amerasian was a reviled figure. And again, is an interesting historical shift there, because that was true. And that's what also made Duk's story to me so heartbreaking, that Duk was a figure of revulsion. Whereas now the image of the Amerasian is on every single like glossy magazine you see and on television commercials. Like, I am the sort of body that would sell you a great Coke product over there.
Yeah.
But I also recognize that the reason they could be excited about me was that I read as completely American. If Duk went back, he would still read as Vietnamese, and they would have another more complex reaction to him. He probably still would be a figure of revulsion, whereas I become some sort of almost a capitalistic kind of object, something to purchase and buy. But that moment of seeing this stranger and recognizing, and he recognized, and he probably thought I was half Vietnamese. And for him to look at me and think, that's somebody who got a better life. And for so many reasons, historically, I have gotten a better life. My body may have political meanings, but I'm not the product of war. And so there, it reminded me of this huge gap between, again, what I could imagine and what I actually knew and what I could actually discover truly. And even something that would make us look like each other actually revealed a greater gulf and a greater distance between us.
I want to come back to that sculpture that is on the cover of the book. You say that that this is the monument that haunted you most. Explain why. You say new emotions seemed to break through the sculpture's jingoistic crust, that people had died on those planes, and there was something triumphant on one hand, but there was something also kind of sad, lamenting and rejoicing in death. What was it about that sculpture that... because here's the thing. You said by visiting that monument, and you did over and over and over again, you wanted to, as you say, numb the sensations that you felt about it and come to some deeper understanding. But you never really did.
And I don't think you can.
That's the point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think what's funny about memorialization and our attempts to create memorials is that oftentimes we're trying to encapsulate what is, at its very nature, outside of the bounds of language and representation. I mean, if you could actually talk about war in a way that encapsulated the entire experience, I think... I can't even imagine the piece of art that could do that. But one of the reasons I was so fascinated by that monument or that sculpture, I don't even know what to call it sometimes, but and because I think it defies certain types of genres. But it made me very aware of the genre of the war memorial. We don't tend to make war memorials out of the material of war. The idea of actually taking real planes and layering them together with no regard for, in some respects, the differences between those wars and historical fact. We like our monuments to be sanitized in a lot of ways. We want to have a context, a historical context that tells us A, who fought, B, who won, C, why we fought at all. And, you know, there's two monuments that sort of haunt me in the book. It's that one in the Vietnam Military History Museum, but then also Maya Lin's memorial, yeah, which does some similar work. It strips us of a kind of elegiac context that either gives us a reason to fight or a reason for how we should imagine that war. It's simply the names listed on a slab of marble carved into the earth. And it also becomes material to us. We have to go up and we touch the names. Yeah. We rub them onto pieces of paper. We can carry those with us. We engage with that monument in ways that usually we have to stand far back, look up, and respect the figure or figures that represent that war for us. So both of these monuments just became really haunting to me because they asked me continually to think about how it is that we live with memories of war or we don't live with memories of war.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, Maya Lin. You have said that when you first encountered the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, that it didn't really make that much sense to you. That there were these names capitalized, alphabetized, just there. But then you heard Maya Lin describe later that she had tried to order the names in the order in which they had died during the war.
Mm-hmm.
Did that help it make somewhat more sense to you? Or what did you make of that, I guess?
I'm still mulling that. I see that as sort of the great koan of that sculpture, you know, because she called it an attempt to re-enter the soldiers and the audience back into the time frame of war.
Yeah.
This idea that there is a way that you can represent a kind of trauma like that that will mean something and get us as close to that event as possible. And the idea of, and it was an impossibility to try and list people in the very order in which they died would be just an impossible task. But it is kind of an amazing one to ponder. You know, when I think about the first time I saw that memorial, I mean, obviously I was 12 years old and it had pretty much just been erected. And so part of the reason we went to see it was as much around the controversy as for any other reason. You know, I went with my uncle who had fought in Vietnam. My father was a non-combat veteran of Vietnam as well. And that's not something that at 12 years old I had any understanding of. But because, you know, Maya Lin is Chinese, that was something that actually had been sort of brought up. My mother wanted to see that because there was a certain moment of Chinese pride to do this. And yet, in some ways, the fact that it was an Asian woman who had created this monument also kind of fed into some of that controversy as well. So again, that memorial means something to me over time in very different ways. Now it's a question of representation in war and what those names can possibly do for us as potential participants in that memorial.
You say if healing depends on the ordering of our memories, going back to this mm-hmm. ordering, which was impossible, but something that Maya Lin had talked about, ordering the names, or if the reconstruction of time through a narrative, we create the fact of war and trauma makes this impossible, you say. To heal, we need to express what cannot be expressed because it defies meaning. It seems like that's a theme in the book, that we're trying to memorialize this thing that's inconceivable, that we can't really make sense of, even though we try, and maybe we should try. It's impossible, it seems.
Yeah, that's the paradox.
Yeah.
And probably that's why it spoke to me so much as a writer, right? Because I've spent my life thinking about how to represent things, my experience, my relationship with others in the world, other people's relationships with themselves, you know, themselves. Representation is at the heart of what I do. And so I was really fascinated and struck by the way we think about and talk about and deal with traumatic survivors of traumatic incidents. Oftentimes the first thing we do is we say, let's narrativize what happened to you, because if you can create a story about it, you can reorder it, you can process it, and potentially you can put it back in your own memory, and you yeah. can see it as a completed event. The irony is that depending on which doctors or theorists you're looking at, there are arguments to be made that That doesn't happen, that you narrativize trauma only to re-narrativize it later on. You return to the scene of the crime because it turns out that narrative falls short. It can't actually create that cathartic moment where you say, okay, that's done. So there's a tremendous amount of repetition. There's also an ethical component, too, which is that in order to narrativize traumatic moments, I think we're often asked to think about protagonists, antagonists, a before, a during, and an after. We narrativize things according to maybe the ways we see movies arranged or books or stories or poems arranged. We think about time in that sense, which I don't think is actually what happens when you experience a traumatic event. It wasn't what Kelton experienced, and I don't, or Tim DeJulis, and I don't think it's what Lee experienced as being sort of almost violently relocated from one culture to the next. There's something absurd at the very heart of an event that we can't process. So we're asked to do something that is actually antithetical to the very event that it describes. When I was younger, I had I was a victim of a fairly violent attack. And all I know about it now is that there are certain things that don't go back in memory. They just don't. And they sort of stick out. But you do create narratives around them.
Yeah.
You have to.
Why?
I think it's because it does give you some sort of meaning. It gives you also a way to communicate to somebody else. I mean, if there's a risk in getting it wrong, I think there's a greater risk in not hearing the stories of traumatized survivors in general. I mean, our whole idea of why the Holocaust is bad is in part due to the tremendous labor that Holocaust survivors did, going out and telling their stories repeatedly to people so that we are aware of the consequences of a genocide in ways that aren't academic.
Yeah.
And if we don't hear those stories, we're more apt to sort of whitewash or forget or just overlook periods of history. So I think that is painful and is as problematic as it is to try to narrativize these moments that stand against narrative, if we don't try to do that, we don't try to communicate, we lose a major part of empathy and an understanding of history that makes it personal.
Is this the difference, in part, between poetry and prose? That we're trying to take these traumatic experiences and create prose with them, when in fact the best way to express them is probably something more abstract, like a poem?
You know, I would have argued against that about 2 years ago, but I think it's true. There's something about lyric time that is like traumatic time. It's recursive, it's fragmentary, it's, you know, sometimes regressive, and it's not progressive. Narrative time, especially when we think about classic narrative nonfiction or fiction, it works into the future with an awareness of the past. And so there is something about, you know, the ways that poetry can actually represent potentially that fragmentary nature of trauma. But at the same time, I think there have been poets that resist using poetry for that reason. You know, I talk about Charles Reznikov in the book and his Holocaust poems and how he used that fragmentary and sort of chaotic time potentially inherent to poetry as a way of shutting the reader down and saying, you won't empathize more.
There's no way to conceivably imagine or fathom this, so don't even try. And I'm going to try to shut you down with the way I'm creating this poetry, basically.
Right. And there's two reasons for that. For Reznikov, it was, you know, an awareness this was a deeply Jewish tragedy.
Yeah.
And while many people were killed and targeted during the Holocaust, Jews were absolutely at the core of that. And the idea that anybody can empathize with the Holocaust or the Holocaust survivor, he found somewhat repulsive and kitschy. You know, because this was a private event in some respects and has to be respected as that. And as I was taking oral histories with post-1975 refugees, I was kind of aware of that also hovering at the surface. Here's an American-born woman from a Chinese background, which comparatively is a very privileged background compared to a lot of the Southeast Asian refugees I'm talking to. And in what ways is my presence making it so that they're going to perform or protect their narrative from me or for me? And I was aware of that. And I can't answer because I'm not in their heads. I don't know what they're going to shelter for me from. But I know everybody I talked to at first would deny that there was anything problematic about their family history when I would say, I just want to get a sense of what it's like to relocate. And they were like, it was fine. It was all fine.
Yeah.
But over the course of a couple of hours, you know, as they got more comfortable, they started talking about how it wasn't fine. But that doesn't mean that they didn't tell me all the ways it wasn't fine. But I understand that. Like, you want to protect your family. You want to protect your history. You don't want to be seen as a pathologized, traumatized individual either.
It's Paisley Rechdahl. She's Utah's poet laureate and an English professor at the University of Utah. Her new book is called The Broken Country, on trauma, a crime, and the continuing legacy of Vietnam. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Utah poet laureate Paisley Rechdahl is with us talking about her latest book, which is an examination about the effects of trauma and war. She builds the book around an incident in April of 2012 when a Vietnamese man stabbed two white men in the parking lot of a Smith's Marketplace in Salt Lake City. Her book is called The Broken Country. Talk about your conversation with Kevin Lee. It seems like he fits into this category. And there's this moment at the end of this section where you write about him, where he gets more and more agitated and animated. It's almost as if his trauma comes to life during your conversation with him.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that Kevin was traumatized, but I think that Kevin was a remarkable person to talk to on so many levels. But
let's explain who he was.
Yeah, so he was one of the first people. He was a friend of a friend, basically. He's a member of the Vietnamese community here in Salt Lake, and he was kind enough to sort of give me a sense. And he knew Keat Thun Lee. He knew his family. And so he could give me an insight into what Lee's family might have experienced, certainly what Kevin Lee's own experience was. And, you know, he could give me a sense of like what it meant to assimilate at that time, like right around like the late, you know, 70s, early 80s to Salt Lake City. And he did grow more animated, but he started out sort of saying, well, you know, it's fine. Everything was good, you know. And he did. He, of all of the people I talked to, he probably had one of the most positive relocations, you know, experiences because, you know, his family had good ties to the American government and all sorts of things. He had certain privileges. But he made three or four fantastic points. He was like, you know, what is crazy at the end? When we want to dismiss the stabber as merely crazy, we miss something. You know, crazy could be the difficulty of living every day in a culture that you are still unable to fully grasp. The language is beyond you. You're afraid of going outside your house or talking to the police for many reasons. You haven't got a lot of friends. Your community is small and sometimes shrinking. The incredible sense of isolation. And he's like, you know, that can wear at you over the course of a lifetime. What is crazy?
Right.
And he said, I could go at any moment. And you know, and I think that when he got to that moment, there was this kind of uncomfortable pause where it was like, you know, that it wasn't so much drug and alcohol abuse and mental health issues as he initially started arguing. He's like, that Lee did what he did because he was crazy. At the end, he was like, you know, I don't know what crazy is.
Yeah.
And
he said, I feel crazy too.
I feel crazy too. Exactly. And if I have no worries that, you know, Kevin is going to go and buy a knife and do it. There's no question of that. But that sense of being permanently dislocated. And part of that permanent dislocation, I think, is also due to the fact that we have to remember that when the refugees first came over, they weren't just leaving a country. They lost that country forever. That country does not exist. You know, it exists as a physical space, but the politics, the culture, the language is also quite different. I mean, that was basically being erased in favor of it's a new country. So the country that he lives in is one that's only inhabited in his parents' memories, not even his own.
I want to ask you more about that, what you learned about the Vietnamese community in Utah, because you were trying to piece together Lee's life. And it's a small enough community that even though his family didn't want to talk to you, his ex-girlfriend didn't want to talk to you, you could sort of put things together, and then it seems like you learned something about this community, and I guess it was much more complicated. The class structure, the social structure, the different waves of refugees and how their experience was different. It was more complicated than I expected, too, as I was looking at the book.
This is where my own racial identity was not actually helpful, because when you grow up in a Chinese American community, you're talking about generations of people who have come and created this these communities, and to a certain extent, there's obviously wild differences and things and stratification in there, but they're built up over time. And when you look at the Southeast Asian community, it is a very potentially fractious group of individuals, obviously, for real reasons. I mean, the first wave of post-1975 refugees, they came over because they had a lot more resources. They had connections to the governments. Yeah. They oftentimes had English as a language. They were better educated. They were joined swiftly by two or three other waves, poorer, less educated. They were joined by Cambodians and the Hmong, Laotians. Mm-hmm. They were also joined by, later on, immigrants from the north. So there were northern Vietnamese, too. And you've got a small enough community, especially in Salt Lake City, it's only 10,000 to 12,000 people, where you can't have the sort of luxury of real divides. Yeah. Everyone's got to get along. And yet you're constantly aware that that person was a soldier fighting in that war, and this person was not. And this person, is very conservative, very pro-American, and this person is definitely not. And they're all kind of eating together and seen by the outsiders as the same, but they are definitely not the same. And I think when I think about Keat Tan Lee, he's somebody who would have been both visible and very invisible to that community. Yeah. Because no one would want to claim somebody who has drug and alcohol problems, mental health issues, is not the model minority, which right. is being constantly held up as, if you're going to assimilate, you might as well look like this.
He came from the second wave, I guess it was. They were generally thought of as poor or less educated. You imagine that he may have been ostracized or even ignored, seen as a figure of shame, you say in the book.
I think so. I mean, in the mental health research I did, in general, Asian populations underreport. Southeast Asians actually are one of the more likely groups to report problems with mental health issues, probably because they've spent more time going into those communities trying to do research actually about the long-term effects of relocation. But that said, they tend not to go forward and get help for family members because of ideas of cultural shame. And so if he was displaying any sort of problems early on, that probably would have been seen as something that only the family should be dealing with. And as it got worse and worse, then it becomes a community policing problem. And that's pretty much when he enters into the record.
I want to ask you about Duc Pham. Mm-hmm. His story is really fascinating, and you begin with the story of him finding an unexploded bomb. He's born mixed race. He's an American father. He was treated cruelly by some of the members of his family. When you were talking to him, you talk about how this was the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. Talk about your conversations with him and what you were trying to learn and what you did.
Yeah, I went in initially, as I do with all of the oral history kind of interviews I was taking, I went in with basically just one question, which is, tell me what your experience was like. And from that, I would winnow it down a bit. I knew I wanted to talk with somebody who was mixed race, Amerasian, because Lee had claimed or was reported to have claimed that he was mixed race himself. Yeah. And Duc was so it was an amazing interview to take with him because his English wasn't terrific. So I had a translator, a friend, helping out with that. But it was a transporting moment because when he started talking about finding that bomb with his brother and the fact that his family had been starving and the fact that, he and his brother were both ostracized for you know, their mother's passed, and the fact that they almost died that day trying to basically find a way to get food with this bomb. It was like you realized, or I realized, that when people tell those stories of trauma, they don't just tell them, they relive them. You know, people, this was so quiet in that kitchen. He was close to tears. I was close to tears. At the end of it, I just, you know, practically just lay down in my car and fell asleep. It was
draining.
So draining. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, that's got to be the same thing for him. But the story that he was telling about that kind of constant dislocation, and also the way in which he was preparing to meet, or hoping to meet eventually, his father, that he was going to look for his father. He could through the database, but he was reluctant to do that because he was still afraid that he would be a figure of shame. I mean, I found that just so heartbreaking.
You say trauma can be inherited, not just, and that's not just a metaphor. It can be actually inherited. Talk about that.
Yeah, trauma is, I say in the book, both a genetic and a cultural wound. Epigenetic research, which lots of people have been probably exposed to now, there was a very popular Nature article about epigenetic research done on mice, and you stress one generation of mice, and it turns out that their offspring are also stressed. And then also the great thing about, you know, so many wars and so many genocides in the last, you know, 200 years, that we now have data that we've collected, is we see that happening with people. We've seen that with Holocaust survivors, the survivors of the Armenian genocide. We see that with American Indian populations. There is a suggestion that we inherit physically PTSD. And depending on whether you inherit it from your mother or your father, you can have different types of PTSD. It seems that if you get it from the father's line, it's harder to process memory, tends more towards aggression. But PTSD has such a long range of symptoms. It includes drug and alcohol use, depression, anxiety, rage, inability to process memory, somatic problems. I mean, it's a really large list of things that can happen. On top of that, it looks like we are not only likely potentially to inherit the traumas, the PTSD of our parents, but it has a tendency to get us into situations where we are re-traumatized. Mm. So if you experienced one, if you have PTSD, you're more likely, it seems, to experience another sort of traumatic event, whether rape or a violent attack or even car crashes, things like that. And they've been tracing that as well. So on that level, we can see that trauma is inherited, but it's also culturally inherited through the stories that we tell ourselves or we repress from our children. And that gets us into stickier, sort of more ethically ambiguous territory, which is how much then can we say someone is traumatized if it's through narrative? And does that raise, I guess, the experience of the spectator to, you know, the same level as the actual victim, right?
Yeah.
And you know, when we think about how much we look at images of war and how many, I mean, there were over 400 movies and films and TV shows made about Vietnam, and that's an early count from the 90s. You know, are we traumatizing ourselves potentially through those kinds of narratives? There's a study that came out recently that said the people that were looking at 9/11 footage, they weren't there in New York. They just watched the videos replay over and over of the towers falling. 10 years later, have signs of PTSD. You know, what that means, I don't exactly know. But the fact that they're displaying those kinds of, you know, symptoms, we have to ask ourselves about the ways that we tell these kinds of stories.
You say that you in the section where you write about the fact that trauma can be inherited, you worry in relying too heavily on the science regarding trauma, you say, because it helps us see people as beyond our help or our responsibility. It's kind of a cautionary note you add. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, I think one of the great things about the scientific research is it both tells us what we know and suggests there might be ways potentially to deal with that, in the sense that, you know, if you know that this is a possibility, you can have better mental health care kind of available readily to the public. You can maybe even watch for it. You can diagnose for it. But We are a culture that tends to fetishize individual responsibility, maybe at the cost of all else. And there's also a way in which that science can sort of say, that person's just damaged beyond control.
Yep.
And then you pathologize them and you sort of say, that's
what happened to Lee, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He's damaged goods and this was his doing.
Yeah.
Let's not try to make sense of it in any other way.
Right.
He did a horrible thing in a parking lot. He almost killed these two guys.
Right. And that is also correct. You know, on the one, I don't dispute that he did it. I don't dispute any of that. But we get into this territory. If we only see him as a medical condition and we don't see that medical condition as attached to history, I think we lose sight of a larger question is what are we doing to people when we send them to war? Because it's not just what happened to Lee. It's what's happening to soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and the soldiers that came back from Vietnam as well. If we don't see wars having long-term effects and we see these things as disconnected and these people as this is a place where pain resides, this is it, there's an endpoint to this, you know, it feeds into that narrative that a war is just over when we say, okay, on April 1975, Saigon fell.
Yeah. It also seems like that we start to see refugees. If we're thinking about allowing refugees into our country, this is precisely what we're thinking about as a country. If we imagine they've been through war and they've been traumatized, then there's a chance we could see them as damaged goods and just not want them here.
Right. And we say that already with immigrants,
yes.
Right? We think of them as some pathologized communities. And that's, again, reason why I think when I was doing these oral interviews, it was so tough. They're aware of that. They're aware, of how refugees are perceived. There's so many things you can say about this. From a scientific point of view, an elevated risk of PTSD is not equivalent to a universal reality or fact. These are people who may have experienced war and have PTSD, some of them, but the larger story is actually one of resilience. If we look at even from Vietnam veterans, for example, 77% of returning veterans did not have PTSD.
Yeah.
And yet we want to see all veterans of that war as traumatized.
This is how we pathologize war.
This is how we pathologize war. And there's a reason why, because the term PTSD comes into fashion. It is medically diagnosed essentially during the Vietnam War.
But why do we do that? Why do we want to pathologize? What are we trying to make sense of it, justify it? Why do we do that?
Well, I think with Vietnam, it's sort of specific, and I think it's located also in the politics, right? Vietnam bleeds and has created the ways that we see war now, right? We didn't think about war as solely catastrophic in the ways that we do now. In some ways, that's a very ahistorical kind of, or a very contemporary way of looking at war.
Because we saw World War II veterans as differently, as heroes and noble, and then Vietnam, and then Iraq, and Afghanistan,
right.
And Korea.
Yeah.
We saw it differently.
And part of it is because Vietnam was a disaster for us, not just abroad, but domestically. The kind of civil unrest from a political standpoint, the civil unrest that the Vietnam War represented and frankly unleashed was both good and bad for the country. You've got the veteran rights movement, you've got the civil rights movement, you've got the women's rights movement. And in some ways, all of these movements were attached to Vietnam War protests as well.
Yeah.
They're involved in it. And so it created a lot of new social movements that moved in very liberal directions. But from a political standpoint, a conservative standpoint, it represented a disaster at home because suddenly we've got a new country. So one of the reasons I think we want to pathologize war out of Vietnam is a sort of sense of what does war bring home?
Yeah.
We don't want the effects of war to come home if they're going to upend our own ideas about our social justice, our system, our civil rights system, the ways in which we see women and men's roles too. But war doesn't just stay abroad. When it comes home, it changes all of us in very surprising ways. And I think that that's the inconvenient truth that people don't want to talk about, because some of those changes are for the good and some of those changes are for the negative. But when we think about war as traumatic, largely, it's because of the ways that we have seen Vietnam as a traumatic event for us physically, for us morally, for us politically.
I want to come back to the that memorial that you went to over and over and over again when you were in Hanoi. You said that you didn't touch the sculpture. and you wish you had. Why? Why didn't you touch it, and why did you end up wishing that you had reached out and actually touched it?
I think I didn't touch it for the very ingrained ways in which I've been trained to look at art and war memorials. You're supposed to stand at a respectful distance and look at it. But rather like the Vietnam War Veterans Memorial that we have, it actually is so material and so physically impressive and inviting in a way. It wants to draw you in. And I think in a way, my resistance also to touching that memorial is similar to my resistance, even writing parts of this book and thinking about this book. We don't like to think of ourselves as implicated in larger arguments. In a weird way, we understand that history is around us all the time. We're a part of history. And yet somehow we also think of ourselves, maybe just me, I think of myself as somehow outside of history. Like these events are over. That happened. But if to touch the war memorial is to sort of acknowledge that, no, actually, even though there is no direct link between me and Vietnam, it's not as if the cultural shifts that took place, the familial shifts that took place, don't have some sort of effect on me either. And when we look at Lee as somebody who's merely a medical condition, we lose sight of how he himself is also part of that war memorial, right? It just continues on to this day.
We were meant to see wars as one continuous narrative, you say. That's the idea. We're supposed to see them as one narrative that doesn't really resolve itself. This is just the condition.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think from an historical point of view, I think you could make the argument, yes, I mean, at some point certain conflicts die out, but then family memory wakes up.
Yeah.
You know, Viet Thanh Nguyen, in his book Nothing Ever Dies, says, you know, we fight wars twice, once in the battlefield and the second time in memory. And the great thing about memory is it's transferable, it's shareable. And so in that sense, it continues on in surprising ways, ways we are just now starting to understand.
That's Utah's poet laureate Paisley Rekdal. Her new book is called The Broken Country, on trauma, a crime, and the continuing legacy of Vietnam. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.